Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The latest on the Durham investigation. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. For some reason, you're not already following us on a streaming service. You can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you? You're in Chile.
I'm doing fine. Yeah, it's cold here, but it's cold everywhere I hear. I understand it was even colder in New Jersey this morning, so I can't complain too much. But, you know, the Mets have won 15 out of the first 21, so I'm like really whipped up for that. But just doesn't feel like baseball season the last 2 weeks or so. I'm hoping hoping we do
it's
better.
It's been a cold spring. So we got more Durham action. So I guess the way to do this, first of all, let's explain that means you what Durham's theory is now, which has become clearer, and you've written about it. And then we'll get into the court action. But what is Durham's theory of the case?
Rich, Durham is basically saying that the false statement to the FBI that he has charged against Michael Sussman, who is the lawyer formerly for the Perkins Coie law firm, who represented the Clinton campaign and represented other people that we'll get into who are relevant to this investigation. The false statement, according to Durham, takes place within the broader framework of what he has called the joint venture and what I've called the big scheme, just to distinguish it from the smaller, narrow charge that he's brought. Basically, what he's saying is the Hillary Clinton campaign concocted the Trump-Russia collusion scenario. And some of its operatives came up with this angle of collusion that involved Alpha Bank, this allegation that Trump and the Kremlin had a communications back channel, internet communications, through servers at Trump Tower and an important Russian financial institution known as Alpha Bank. They put that information together from internet records that they had privileged access to, in part because there were contractual relationships with the government, which were designed to protect American cybersecurity, but they exploited for purposes of doing campaign opposition research on behalf of Hillary Clinton. They shared this information through the spring and summer of 2016 with top officials in the Clinton campaign, mainly. The main connection here would be the law firm, because Sussman, who is the defendant here, is representing one of the tech executives who actually compiled this internet data. And Sussman has also represented the Clinton campaign directly on cyber issues. His partner at the time at the law firm was Mark Elias, who is the main lawyer for the Clinton campaign and for the DNC. Sussman had also represented the DNC in connection with the alleged Russian hack on their servers earlier in 2016. So in the course of all this, in connection with trying to build this narrative that Trump had a corrupt relationship with the Kremlin, Elias also recruited the opposition research firm Fusion GPS, which was started by one of its co-founders, is Glenn Simpson. And he retains them for this anti-Russia project. And it's Simpson who brings in, if you recall, Christopher Steele, who is the one who makes the infamous Steele dossier. That's kind of a sideline, not completely, but it's kind of a sideline here. But I would just note, as long as we're going through the time frame, that Elias brings in Fusion and Simpson recruits Steele, And Steele ends up recruiting this guy, Igor Danchenko, who is his source for much of the stuff in the nonsense in the Steele dossier. I mentioned Danchenko in this connection only because the other case that Durham has brought is a false statements case against Danchenko. So he's got one against Sussman and one against Danchenko. So during the spring and summer of 2016, there are meetings between the tech executive who compiled all this information, whose name is Rodney Jaffe, Sussman, Elias, and Simpson. Sussman also meets with Steele at a certain point. And one of the ways, Rich, this goes to show how sinister this is in its way, they're basically concocting this Alpha Bank back channel, communications back channel story. And part of what Sussman has, what Durham has in the Sussman indictment is all these communications between the internet researchers where it's clear that they know that this is nonsense, that there's nothing to it. And what Jaffe basically tells them is, look, it doesn't need to be bulletproof. It just needs to be something that we can stir up. You know, it needs to be plausible enough that we can stir up a story out of it. So he doesn't out and out say to them, it's okay to be false. What he basically says is we have to be able to cherry pick information enough that we can create some smoke, that we can create an impression that there might be something bad going on here. The reason I mention this in this connection is once they put together this Alpha Bank part of the collusion narrative, Jaffe shares it with Sussman. Sussman shares it with Steele and Fusion GPS. Steele ends up writing it into the dossier, and that's what ends up going to the FBI, which they use to get FISA warrants on the guy connected to Trump's campaign. So you can see that this is more than just a political dirty trick. It's having actual real world legal consequences. And just so people have a framework for where I'm going with this, this is like a classic dirty trick type of thing where one side in a political campaign comes up with a narrative of corruption about the other side, tries to get the media interested in it, tries to get law enforcement interested in it. And if they succeed in getting law enforcement interested in it, then they go back to the media saying that it's so serious that law enforcement is actually investigating it. So in the confines of the political campaign, it almost doesn't matter whether it's true or not. All they're trying to do is get law enforcement to pay attention to it so that they can convince the electorate that there must be something there. Otherwise, the FBI wouldn't be looking at it. So that's basically the scheme. Sussman, Elias, Jaffe, Fusion, all meet over the Alpha Bank angle during the spring and summer of 2016. And eventually, when they're ready, they have Sussman reach out to his old friend, James Baker. Baker, at that point in time, is the general counsel for the FBI. But Sussman was formerly, for a number of years, a cybersecurity lawyer at the Justice Department. And he knows Baker for years because they've both been government lawyers working in the national security realm. Most people who wanted to report misconduct, potential crime to the FBI, would have to call the FBI and go through whatever case agent was on duty. Sussman, by contrast, because he's a very connected guy in Washington and because he's trading on his former law enforcement credentials, happens to have Jim Baker's number in his phone. So he texts him on a Sunday night and says to him, look, let me exactly quote this because I don't want to get this wrong. He says in the text, this is on September 19th, 2016, Jim, it's Michael Sussman. I have something time sensitive and sensitive I need to discuss. Do you have availability for a short meeting tomorrow? I'm coming on my own, not on behalf of a client or company. want to help the Bureau. Thanks. So that's the text. And what Durham details extensively in the indictment is that at the time that he sends this text, Sussman is representing Jaffe, representing Jaffe's company, which is Neustar, and representing the Clinton campaign, had represented the Clinton campaign as its cybersecurity lawyer. And for all this work he's doing on the Alphabet angle, the Alpha Bank angle, he is billing his time to Perkins Coie's Clinton campaign account. So he's representing both the Clinton campaign and Jaffe when he texts and tells Baker that he's not representing any company or any client. And I should also point out that Jaffe is expecting to get a big cybersecurity job in the government if Hillary Clinton wins the election. So there are people who have, you know, both political interest and self interest that are deeply involved here. So bottom line is Baker gives him the meeting the next day. I think I said that the text was September 19th. Actually, that's wrong. The meeting was September 19th. The text is Sunday night, September 18th. I think the next morning at the FBI headquarters, Baker gives Sussman the meeting. It's a one-on-one meeting between the two of them, which would make it a very tough false statements case if that's all there was, you know, because there's no transcript, there's no recording, it's just the two guys there. It's not even a normal FBI meeting where you'd have two agents there so that two people could testify and one is taking notes of what's been said. This is just these two lawyers who know each other for a million years having a one-on-one meeting. But now, because we have the text, we have a direct statement from Sussman himself, assuming, and I have no reason not to assume this, that the text is authentic. That's a pretty clear statement by Sussman that he was claiming not to be representing anyone in connection with this. At the meeting, Sussman gives Baker, I think it's three white papers analyzing this internet data and a couple of thumb drives that have raw internet communications data on it. And it's been sculpted to make it look like there's something nefarious in the communications between this server at, I think it's two servers actually at Alpha Bank, and one that the internet researchers connect to Trump because Trump's name is in the domain name. The reason I make that distinction, Rich, is when the FBI ultimately investigates this, and the bottom line here, by the way, is the FBI does open this investigation. That's the reason that they wanted to attract them. The whole idea was to get them to be curious and investigate. But when the FBI does investigate this, what they learn is that what the internet researchers assumed was a Trump server is in fact a mass marketing company's server, and they send out tons of emails basically to sell deals at, you know, things like hotels. Like if people who do business travel who stay in the Trump hotels around the world, there's a lot of that kind of traffic. But what the FBI finds out, and obviously the internet researchers could easily have found this out and easily have pointed it out, what the FBI learns is that this server is neither operated nor administered by the Trump campaign or by Trump or the Trump organization. And of course, obviously, if the internet researchers had pointed that out to the FBI, there would be nothing to the Alpha Bank story. So they didn't. So now that's the scheme. And just to play it out a little bit more, the Clinton people get very upset ultimately because the FBI ends up leaking to the New York Times that they've looked at the Alpha Bank thing in particular and the Trump collusion claims in general, and that there's nothing there. And I think the FBI leaked that in response to the Clinton campaign leaking that the FBI believed that there was something nefarious going on between Trump and Russia. And later, after Hillary loses the election, Sussman goes back to the government, this time to the CIA. This is in February of 2017, after Trump has been in office for 3 weeks. And he brings them an updated version of this information. And that's relevant. And even though the Durham hasn't charged this in his indictment, he wants to prove it in the trial. It's relevant because the CIA analyzes the data that Sussman brought them, and they make a determination that the FBI never reached, which is that the information is fraudulent, that it's bogus, it's spoofed, it's fabricated. Now, when I say the FBI didn't reach that conclusion, I'm not saying the FBI reached a contrary conclusion. I think what happened with the FBI is they looked at this and they decided there was insufficient evidence to predicate a full-blown investigation. And they didn't go into whether the information that they had been provided was fabricated. They just decided that it wasn't enough to make a case. I think they made an assumption that this was over exuberance on behalf of people who didn't like Trump, and they just dismissed it at that. They didn't investigate the information to see whether someone had tried to commit a fraud on the government. The CIA did, and the CIA looked at it and decided it was completely bogus. So that's the big scheme, and this is what Durham would like to prove at the trial. And what he'd really like to prove is the part of the scheme that ropes in the top people in the Clinton campaign, including Hillary Clinton herself. So on Halloween, on October 31st, like 8 days before the election, Hillary Clinton tweets, "Donald Trump has a secret server. It was set up to communicate privately with a Putin-tied Russian bank." On the same day, she tweets, "Computer scientists have apparently uncovered a covert server linking the Trump Organization to a Russian-based bank." And Clinton's top national security spokesman for her campaign, Jake Sullivan, who is now Biden's national security advisor, also tweets out a statement that basically says, "This could be the most direct link yet between Donald Trump and Moscow. This secret hotline may be the key to unlocking the mystery of Trump's ties to Russia." And he finally adds, "We can only assume that federal authorities will now explore this direct connection between Trump and Russia." And I think it was that series of announcements, Rich, that probably induced the FBI to leak that they had investigated and found that there was nothing there, which they did, by the way, to the New York Times, which fully expected that Hillary was going to win the election, and has done the walk of shame ever since, that they published this thing before the election, because it really kind of torpedoed this whole, at least at that time, the whole Trump collusion thing. So Durham wants to prove this big scheme in order to say that to understand why Sussman allegedly lied to the FBI, you have to understand the big scheme and you have to understand what it was that he was trying to accomplish. And this goes to, it's common in federal law to prove evidence of a common scheme if it's relevant to the crime at issue, even if the crime is not conspiracy. Prosecutors are always entitled to prove motive. So to the extent this goes to motive and intent, it's relevant for that reason as well. And what Durham would like to prove is everything from how this whole collusion narrative got started through the Hillary campaign tweets in October of 2016, and even into 2017 when Sussman tries to bring this information to the CIA. So as we've been discussing on the podcast, Rich, in the last couple of weeks, what's going on now, which is common in criminal trial practice, is they're having these motions in limine, where both sides are trying to limit what each can do in the trial. And Durham has been trying to argue that he should be able to get these tweets in from Hillary and from Sullivan. And that was part of what they litigated this week. And at the end of a very long hearing, in kind of a throwaway way, which is interesting because on with respect to other not as consequential items, the judge in this case, whose name is Christopher, they call him Casey Cooper. Judge Cooper has written opinions in with respect to other questions that have come up about why evidence is going to be allowed in and why it's kept out. Here, at the end of a couple of hour hearing, as he's basically leaving the bench, he does a throwaway line that says the tweets are out. And he says, look, they're hearsay anyway, and they're duplicative, and I'm keeping them out. So he hasn't gone to paper on that. Maybe he will, but he hasn't up until now. I suspect he won't because they're not, it's not, you know, his. We can get into this, but his legal reasoning on this is not very compelling. But anyway, he has kept this out. And I think I don't want to drone on much longer here, but I think this is the issue that I tried to highlight in a couple of columns over the last week, because it's a complicated part of a prosecution where you have a crime that's charged that takes place within the framework of a bigger scheme that's not charged. There's a lot of federal authority, case law, rules of evidence, et cetera, for the proposition that prosecutors should be able to get in relevant evidence, especially when, like here, it goes to motive and scheme. But there's always a hesitance on the part of federal judges when they worry that the scheme that hasn't been charged that the prosecutor is trying to prove is actually more egregious than the crime that's charged in the indictment. And I think this is what Durham has to wrestle with here. If he had wanted to get all this Hillary proof in and the big scheme proof in, the best way to do that would have been to charge people who were involved in it with fraud on the United States. Durham didn't do that. And I think I'll close with this. I think what Judge Cooper is basically saying to Durham is this is the Michael Sussman false statements trial. You are not turning it into the Hillary Clinton fraud on the government trial. If you want to indict Hillary Clinton for fraud on the government, then indict her for fraud on the government. But we're not trying Hillary Clinton in this case. We're trying Sussman.
Yeah. So that's exactly what I was going to ask next is what effect does the tweets being in or out have on the actual case against Sussman?
Well, here's what Cooper says, Rich. He's got two grounds that he says he keeps this out. And the second ground, I think, goes to exactly your question. But let me deal with both of them since we brought them up. The first ground, he says, is he's not letting the tweets in because they're hearsay. Now, that will probably resonate with people when they hear that, because everybody thinks hearsay is just, you know, something that happens outside of court, some conversation that happens outside of court. So I'm an FBI agent and John tells me that Jim robbed the bank. That's hearsay that Jim robbed the bank.
Right. But like video evidence of Jim robbing the bank is not hearsay.
I'm sorry?
But if you have black and white evidence of the bank robbery, that's not hearsay.
Right.
But if someone told me Hillary Clinton tweeted stuff about Trump being connected to the FBI, that would be hearsay. Right. But if we have the tweets themselves, that's not hearsay.
Well, they're still out of court statements.
Right.
So out of court statements, you know, presumptively people see out of court statements, they think they're hearsay.
But that's not hearsay.
Well, here's the technical legal definition of hearsay is an out of court statement, or if you lawyer fans out there want to really go crazy, an extrajudicial statement that is offered for the truth of the matter asserted. So in other words, John tells me that Jim robbed the bank. Mm-hmm. If my purpose of entering that into evidence is to prove the fact that Jim robbed the bank, then it's hearsay, right? Because it's offered, right, for the truth of the matter asserted. But what if I'm proving it in order to prove that John lied to me? In other words, we know Jim didn't rob the bank, And what I want to prove is not that Jim robbed the bank, but that John told me Jim robbed the bank so that I could show that John is a liar. In that instance, even though it's still an out-of-court statement, I'm not offering it for the truth of the matter asserted. I'm offering it because of the fact that it was made, because it helps me prove that John's a liar. Mm-hmm. That's allowed because it's not hearsay. You have a proper purpose to put it in. So with that in mind, I think Casey Cooper's ruling that this is hearsay is preposterous, because Durham wants to put these tweets out precisely for, because they're false. Durham is not trying to prove that there actually was a corrupt relationship between Trump and Russia, which Alpha Bank was the facility of for purposes of communication. He's trying to prove the opposite. He's trying to prove that this was a big concoction, that it was all false from the beginning, and that these tweets are false, and that they were put out in connection with a scheme that was designed to smear Trump as having this corrupt relationship with Russia. So how Cooper gets that that's hearsay is beyond me. And I think, you know, you can tell by the fact that he said it so dismissively, he didn't go to paper on it. He doesn't want to write an opinion that says that, I'm sure, you know, a published opinion with his name on it. So I think that ground is just wrong. The second ground, which goes to the question that you asked me in the first place, is more defensible and I think more interesting. And that is, he says that it would be duplicative of other evidence that will come into the case. And what I think, if you can properly not, I'm trying not to overinterpret what he said because he didn't write an opinion and really explain himself. But what I glean him to mean by that is he is going to give Durham latitude to prove that Sussman was representing the Clinton campaign when he lied to the FBI, allegedly, about whether he was representing anyone. So what I take, Cooper to be saying here is, look, you haven't alleged a fraud on the government here. So the only relevance of the tweets are the relationship between the Clinton campaign and Sussman. And I am going to let you prove in the trial that Sussman was working for the campaign because you have all these billing records from the law firm and you have a number of other things that he can show, that he can prove in order to show that Sussman was representing the Clinton campaign at the time he told Baker he wasn't representing anyone. And for purposes of what's charged in this case, as opposed to the big scheme, that's the relevant thing. Did Sussman lie to the FBI? So I think when Cooper says he's not going to let him prove the tweets because they're duplicative, what he's saying is he's going to let other evidence in showing that Sussman was working for the Clinton campaign, and therefore Durham doesn't need the tweets. Now, this, as a former prosecutor, it always drove me nuts when a judge said you don't need it, because I'm like, I'm proving the case here. I'll decide what I need. What you have to decide is whether what I think I need comes within the four corners of the rules of evidence as they've been interpreted by the courts. If they do, you're supposed to let it in and not let me worry about whether I need it or not. But I think what Cooper is basically saying is, look, you don't need the tweets, and we're not turning this into the Hillary Clinton trial. You want to try Hillary Clinton, then go indict Hillary Clinton, but we're not doing that here. And that's not crazy, I have to say.
And how much does it matter to Durham if the end game here, as you've argued repeatedly, is to write a big report? Why do you need, you know, maybe it helps you in the case against Sussman, but the end of the day, you're going to write a big report that gets all this stuff in.
Well, let me treat this more as a political question than a legal question, and then turn it on you, which is, how much do you care about Durham's ultimate report if he can't convict Sussman? Or more broadly, not you personally, Rich, but how much will people
care? Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. That was another question I was thinking of asking you.
Like, but I asked you first.
So what happens if Sussman gets off? And it will discredit his report. I would have to say it'd be a pretty big blow if Sussman gets off, right? Because this might be the signature prosecution of this investigation. And niceties tend to get lost, and it's whether you put a W or a L on the board. So I think it would hurt him.
Yeah, I think so. Now, I think, you know, this is why I thought when he first indicted the case, I was like, man, because all we knew at that point was that it was a one-on-one meeting between Baker and Sussman. And, you know, Durham had this thing where he basically said, as soon as the meeting was over, Baker went back and briefed the head of the counterintelligence section at the FBI. And that guy took notes and wrote down that, you know, Sussman said that he's not here on behalf of a client or not. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, it's really iffy whether a judge had let that in, because that is, you know, that is hearsay, because this would be an out of court statement by Baker, which is offered for the truth of the matter asserted, namely that Sussman was not representing a client. Durham would be trying to get it in because of the fact that it was made, not for the truth of the matter asserted. In other words, what will happen at the trial is, and this is what I thought before we knew about the tweet, Baker would say, presumably, that Sussman indicated to him that he was not representing any client or not. And then he would be cross-examined by Sussman's counsel to try to poke holes in whether Baker's recollection was accurate or not. So then what Durham would try to do is call this other FBI agent to say that right after the meeting, when his recollection was most fresh, Baker said that Sussman had said that he wasn't representing a client. And what Durham would argue is, this is offered not for the truth of the matter asserted, but offered to prove that when his memory was freshest, Baker said it to this other agent. And then a judge would have to decide whether to let it in or not. And you could see why that would go either way, right? But now that we know we have the tweet, I'm sorry, the text from Sussman to Baker, I'm really curious about this, because it seems to me that if Durham had that text when he was writing the indictment, I can't imagine that he wouldn't have put it in the indictment. And I also can't imagine that he wouldn't have charged it straight up, maybe by itself, as a false statement. But it's certainly, you know, part of the pattern that leads to this false statement that he's alleged. So he should be able to get that in. When I say get that in, I mean he should be able to get it admitted as evidence in front of the jury. But the reason I do this discursion on the tweet is, I thought, you know, it's risky for Durham to be bringing these prosecutions if his goal is, or if his idea of accountability ultimately is to write this report. Because if he loses these cases, I think the interest in his report is going to wane significantly. Mm-hmm. And they're not that important in and of themselves. I mean, if you think about it, the idea of trying to do a massive political dirty trick where you not only smear your opponent, but you get the FBI to investigate him as a clandestine agent of Russia, you funnel this information into the State Department, you funnel the information into the CIA, that's pretty serious stuff. And compared to that, these false statements of, you know, I said I wasn't representing anyone when I was actually representing Hillary. Yeah, that's bad. But, you know, compared to the big scheme, it's kind of small potatoes. So he's taking a big risk in terms of the how seriously people take the ultimate report by bringing these cases. So he better win them if he wants the report to be taken seriously. And I now think this false statements case is a lot stronger than I thought it was when he indicted it, because you have the text and you also have these people. I actually think Durham has something of a wicked sense of humor in this, where he's actually subpoenaed, you know, Clinton for America, the Hillary campaign, and Jaffe and some other relevant, Fusion GPS. So they can all come in and say, I'm not going to answer questions because of the attorney-client privilege that we have with Sussman. When the whole case is about him saying that he didn't have an attorney-client relationship with them. So I think it's a pretty strong false statements case. And I think, unfortunately for Durham, in terms of wanting to prove the big scheme, if Judge Cooper thinks it's a strong false statements case, he's going to be leery about giving him a lot of latitude to prove the big scheme. I think he'll let him do some things, but he's not going to let him get into Hillary too much.
Yeah. So let's hit another hot button topic, which is the border. We had Mayorkas in front of Congress this week. We have this Title 42 revocation looming. And now we have this argument in the Supreme Court about Remain in Mexico, which was highly successful Trump era policy to have asylum seekers pursue their asylum claims or have their asylum claims adjudicated while they stayed in Mexico. So they're not in the United States, because if they're in the United States, they're not leaving, even if their asylum claim is rejected. Biden reverses this policy. Red states sue. They actually win on our old friend, the APA grounds. This is appealed, but the stay from the court lower down is not overturned by an appeals court or the Supreme Court. Now it's back up again in the Supreme Court, and we had oral arguments. One, is that summary accurate? Two, what were the issues that surfaced in these arguments?
Summary is accurate, Rich. The only thing I would add to it is that in the interim, the Biden administration has tried to beef up their APA basis for doing this. I mean, basically, they yet again ignored the APA. We discussed that in the context of another case last week. This is another instance where they just decided to strike a Trump policy without doing anything. And the Supreme Court actually, you know, to Charlie's point that he's made a number of times, the Supreme Court actually cited the DACA case in saying you don't just get to, you know, cancel the policy. So that's what brings us up to date. I thought the most interesting statement, which was posed as a rhetorical question in the oral argument, was when Chief Justice Roberts looked at the lawyer for the states, I think the Solicitor General of Texas, and said to him, "Why is this our problem?" Which I imagine the Supreme Court wants to say that quite a bit. But in this instance, I thought it was a very interesting comment, because, you know, the court can be very muscular and aggressive in a number of areas, as we frequently criticize them for being too aggressive, for getting into areas that they shouldn't get into. But immigration and border security are like one of these areas where what can the court do about it? And I think that the tell behind what I've been like a broken record on this, but I'm gonna do it again anyway. The tell behind what Chief Justice Roberts observed there is the fact that we're under a congressional statute that could not be clearer, that says that people who try to enter the United States without authority, and this is a quote, shall be detained until they get a determination of their hearing. What ends up happening, of course, is they seek asylum, and the whole problem that we're dealing with down there, which is more of a catastrophe than a problem, is that we give people, no matter how frivolous the claim is, the right to claim asylum when they come in, even though, generally speaking, their basis for claiming asylum is frivolous. They just want to be in the United States because it's a better place, right? Which is not the basis for an asylum claim. So in probably 98%, 99%+ of the cases where there's really no viable asylum claim, the law of the United States is very clear. This is an issue that is given to Congress by the Constitution to regulate. Congress has passed a statute that says that these people shall be detained. And administrations of both parties have rationalized that they don't have to follow the law. So I think what Chief Justice Roberts is saying here is, suppose we issue an opinion because, and he quoted Marbury versus Madison here, you know, the timeless wisdom of John Marshall, that the, you know, the duty of the Supreme Court is to say what the law is. Robert said we could issue an opinion that says what the law is, and the law is that these people must be detained because Congress has the authority to say that, and they've said that. So Congress has already said it. How does it help you that we say it? The court is in no position to do anything about the executive branch. They can't make them follow the law. The branch that could make them follow the law is Congress. And they've already spoken about as clearly as they could speak about what the law is. And they haven't done anything about the fact that multiple administrations have refused to follow it. So that's what the case is about. Does the executive branch have a right or have some plausible authority for not following the law? And if they don't, then who can do anything about it?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they claim that they have a couple of bases. The Biden administration, to my mind, absurd bases to depart from the law. They point to one subsection of the same statute where Congress says that these people are supposed to be detained, which says that if somebody is arrested or somebody is an alien, I don't want to insult anyone. I mean, a migrant here. I'm sorry if I hurt anyone's feelings there.
It's irregular migration is what we're the phenomenon we're talking about here, Andy.
Oh man, is there Latin for that?
Actually, if it's happening all the time, it's regular migration as well. So right. It's not even accurate.
Right, exactly right. But this other subsection of the statute says that if one of the irregular migrants is caught in a contiguous country, which means obviously Mexico or Canada, the administration or the Homeland Security Department may, and this is the word that the Biden administration underscores, may allow them to remain in the contiguous country while the proceedings are underway. So the Biden administration cites that word may, and they say this shows that Congress actually meant to give the president discretion here. And it doesn't say that at all. What it says is, if you allow them to stay, what it says is you may allow them to stay in Mexico or Canada, in which case they're going to be under whatever the legal restrictions are in Mexico and Canada. But that doesn't change the fact that if you bring them into the United States to wait for their proceedings, they must be detained because that's what Congress says. So there's no contradiction there. And the Biden administration is trying to suggest that there's discretion where there's not. Then here's my favorite one. There's another provision of immigration law, which says that the executive branch, in its discretion, can allow on a case-by-case basis, an illegal alien to come into the country at liberty if doing so presents a significant public benefit. So I became somewhat familiar with this provision and provisions like it in the immigration law when I was a prosecutor, because every now and then you want to bring somebody in from the outside who doesn't have any right to be in the United States, but has relevant information that can be used in a trial, which will help the government prosecute, say, terrorists, in which case you can see why there would be a significant public benefit to allowing the person to come into the United States. But the Biden administration, what the Biden administration is doing has nothing to do with a case-by-case basis. They don't let people, they're not studying every one of these cases on a case-by-case basis and deciding, does this person give us a significant public benefit? They're letting hundreds of thousands of people, they have let over 2 million people into the country in less than 2 years.
Yeah.
There's been 800,000 since the beginning of this year.
Yeah, this argument is such a travesty when Obama was making it for DACA as well.
Yeah. And the part I've gotten, the case-by-case basis, that's only the start of it. Here's the kicker. Guess what they say the significant public benefit is? And this was, Justice Kavanaugh had to ask them about this a couple of times and try to like articulate it for himself because he in trying to wrap his head around it. What they're basically saying is, on the basis of records that we get that are not at all reliable because they're criminal justice records from other countries, so who knows whether they're accurate or not, on the basis of a cursory interview and whatever paper trail we get from the other country, they're concluding that these people aren't that bad. And therefore, the public benefit that we get by letting them into the country is it clears the prison space that they would be taking up so that the Biden administration can lock up and detain the people who were really bad. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, not only is that insane in terms of like logic, but the other thing here is there are only 34,000. There is only space for 34,000 people to be detained. And just last month, we had 221,000 people come, which is what's happening every month. So they don't have space to detain really bad people anymore.
Right.
And I would also point out here, Rich, I didn't know this until I did some research on this yesterday. Do you know that we now have like 220,000 people a month coming to the border? They have 34,000. They have space for 34,000 detainees. In their last budget, they sought to cut the space from 34,000 to 30,000. I mean, they're not at all serious.
That's classic.
They're not at all serious about this at all. So, you know, I think Biden may well win the case, in part because the Supreme Court doesn't really see anything that they can do about this, but in part because the court interjected this, and there's really not a good answer to it from the states, which is, remain in Mexico is a policy that required diplomacy between the United States and Mexico. Diplomacy, foreign relations, the conduct of foreign relations is the plenary power of the executive branch in our system. The only exceptions to that are where the Constitution gives Congress a role, like with treaties. Other than that, it's a plenary power and the court has no authority over it. So, the court can't tell Biden to negotiate with Mexico, and the court is powerless to tell Mexico to do anything. So I think what the justices may ultimately say is, look, our job is to say what the law is. The law of the United States is people who are not authorized to be here are supposed to be detained. That's what the law says. We're sympathetic to the fact that if Congress wants to make the law work, they should appropriate more resources to make detention less illusory. By the way, I think that's itself absurd because, to my mind, if you have 34,000 spaces to keep detained people, then you can't let any more than 34,000 people in. You close the border until you can free up the space. The idea that they have to, that a law has to be broken, so the law that gets broken is the congressional mandate that illegal aliens be detained rather than, you know, what they imagine their obligations are when somebody sets foot on the United States is just absurd. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, yes, I'm sympathetic to the idea that Congress should appropriate more resources, especially now that we have a complete friggin' disaster down there.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, we can't do anything about it because 200,000 people want to come and we only have 34,000 spaces for detained people. So we have to let everybody in. Who says you have to let everybody in? I mean, what on earth?
Yeah. I mean, this goes to a key absurdity of Title 42. Why are we relying on an edict of the CDC to make it possible to turn around illegal migrants at our own border? It makes zero sense.
And
they haven't really even been enforcing Title 42 that robustly. Anyway, that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.